Welcome to the Africa Speaking Podcast. The podcast discusses critical issues about the African continent. It is brought to you by Toyota Communications in Nairobi. My name is Kimani Njogu. Thank you again for accepting to talk with me in this Africa Speaking Podcast. So, in our last conversation, Chief Justice Mutunga, we discussed radical Pan-Africanism. But today I would like to discuss with you about constitution making in Kenya. You have been at the center of constitution making in Kenya in your various roles within civil society and the judiciary. Could you kindly sketch for me the journey that you have walked in the constitution making process?
I think the journey begins even before I joined the University of Nairobi as a lecturer. I was aware that immediately after independence, as the change amendments were being made, there were voices that basically said, you know, this wasn't independence. It was a capitulation. Of course, they didn't use the word neocolonialism, but the intellectuals did. Or basically saying this constitution is a pact that continues our domination and lack of freedom, you know, etc. And there was, during those periods, of course, a lot of underground leaflets and pamphlets. And one of the one I remember reading in the 60s was Munguzi. It was done by people like Mochi Washira and others.
Yes.
And it was a call for a new constitution. They were basically saying the independence constitution was just a sellout. And
so which period is this? In the 19...
So it's late 60s.
Late 60s,
yeah,
wow,
yeah,
great.
Because I'm...
Before you went to the University of Dar es Salaam.
Right, before I went there. Mm-hmm. Because I went to the University of Dar es Salaam in 68. Mm-hmm. But at Strathmore, of course, we were followers and members of Kenya People's Union.
Correct.
And they were talking about these issues as well. A new constitution, their position, that is Kagias, Odingas, and P.O. Gama Pinto, their position on land was clear. If you look at the KPU manifesto, there were 90 declarations, as they called it. It has all those details about the constitution, how the economy is to be managed, and the fact that we shouldn't have accepted the willing buyer, willing seller, you know, nonsense of the independence constitution. Because you remember even is Nyerere who laughed at it and says this willing buyer, willing seller, It's interesting. Ni kama mtu anakuibia koti, kisha analiweka na baadaye anakuja na kuambia koti lako sasa ni lakini lipe. So it's the same thing, you know, you've taken my coat, you've stolen my coat and you tell me to pay to get it back. And the idea here was that the British did not buy that land, they stole it. Okay? Even against their own laws.
Absolutely.
Where thieves don't pass title. All right, they used all manner of things, obviously doctrines in international law, to legitimize the, you know, the theft. But we can't imagine if the Mau Mau war had succeeded, the British selling land to anybody. They were going to be evicted by those forces from
going
the,
to be taken.
Yeah,
and that was also the period that you're right. I think there were all these leaflets. That's when Abdul Latif Abdallah, for example, was Kenya to end up.
Yeah,
so there was all these very active activities questioning the direction that Kenya was taking in the 60s.
Yeah. And when I get to the university then, and we come up with December 12th movement. It was called December 12th movement to signal that it started at the eve of independence.
There is no break.
Yeah. You know, it's this what Rodney keeps on calling links and continuities.
Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You see, all these scholars and activists, even before we get to KPU, they were talking about these issues. And I remember being in December 12th movement and when Pambana was, the first issue was written, the discussion around why December 12th movement is that continuity. So basically saying the struggles for land and freedom did not stop with the constitution, you know, and they continued. And then, of course, that was also borrowed from KPU, you know, with their very, very, very radical, you know, manifesto.
The Kenya People's Union.
Yes, yeah, the yeah. Kenya People's Union. And you find, you definitely find parts of that in Mwa Kenya as well.
And also Mpatanishi, I think some of the
writings.
Mpatanishi
writings,
which is
those was Mwa Kenya. And when they go to London, akina Yusufu, akina Wangui Wagoro, Ngugi, the constitution was always seen as a pathway to discussions of transformation and change. And within the university staff union, as we called it, because we included the staff and students, that issue of constitution making was there, because as you understand, the way that even the independence constitution was mutilated from the word go, which is something, by the way, Githu, in his new book, which was his doctoral thesis, Constitution, Politics and Society, I think he covers all those amendments.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a government that is actually coming up with amendments to consolidate the dictatorship of the executive. But at the same time, people are still calling for constitution, so that the constitution becomes a form or a strategy for resistance. So I participated in the DTM. Mwa Kenya happened when I was, you know, in prison. So when I came out, it's actually human rights now, you know.
Because that's when they are now forming now the Kenya Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, but before I was detained, I was working with Kituo cha Sheria, you know, we were giving legal aid and legal advice for free. It started in Shauri Moyo, but I didn't go there myself. I went to Isili Community Center, where we had an office. So Kituo is the oldest.
And you are focused very much on workers' rights, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why we went to Isili Community Center, so that the workers and, you know, can come in. And when I was interrogated by the police, they were asking me, why are you in the, you know, working class areas and not charging? Which lawyer doesn't charge for legal fees and so forth?
They had never heard of the pro bono.
No, they hadn't heard of it. So I came in from detention and rejoined Kituo cha Sheria with Muta Sajafa, you know, the late David Kachuki, Jane Weru, and Gilbert Mungu. And we basically, you know, continued. And the question of constitution making was never disengaged. And then you see the so-called second liberation, of course, and the repeal of Section 2A was now a political movement that basically said the constitution has to be changed. They targeted 2A. So that there could be multipartism. But when that happened, when 2A was, you know, repealed, then they basically said, no, that's not enough. Mm. This entire constitution
needs an
overhaul.
Yeah.
That was basically the continuation, and that's how we got into NCA, NCC, as part of it with political parties, and ended up with the IPPG, you know, minimal reforms. Although at that time, a lot of young people are saying, we don't want minimal, we want comprehensive.
Comprehensive.
Yeah, so there was that bit, which we lost out when the political parties joined the IPPG and NCC. NCA became extremely weak. There was a discussion whether we could start our own, you know, movement and party after that, but there was no, you know, no conclusion for it. And so minimal reforms, but almost immediately in 1998, the debate for comprehensive, you know, constitutional reform happened.
It picked up.
And you have these two routes, the parliamentary route, and the other one of Ufungamano, which Dr. Mbaka was chair of. Then 2003, Yash Guy comes and
now picks the CKRC.
Yes, CKRC, and brings those particular ones. But you know, to just to finalize the sketch, after the NARC government,
there's the National Rainbow Coalition.
Yes, when they came in
2002.
Yes, when they came in, they couldn't avoid the constitutional project, and that's how they got Guy in 2003 to come and start. And of course, I was a member of the
Bombers Conference, yes, which then came up with what we are calling the Bombers Draft. And so
yes, I was member of that. You know, 408. I remember
that was your number.
Yes, that was my number because you had to lift.
Correct.
And number 408.
Yeah. Be given space to speak.
Yeah, but it's during that time, of course, at 2004. I joined the foundation.
The Ford Foundation,
the civil society. But within the Ford Foundation, of course, a lot of resources went into constitution making, human rights, civil society activities, and so forth, you know, during that period. So I was too engaged. Going to the judiciary, the reason why I applied was there was the 2010 constitution. And I thought, why not, you know, go to the apex court and see what the judiciary could, what we could do, because it was very, very clear that, you know, the judiciary was going to be pivotal in the implementation of that progressive constitution. Yeah. And after that, I've been involved in issues of implementation, because constitution making doesn't end with that document. It continues with the implementation and
constant reflection on it and so on.
Yeah. So my participation has been basically in writings, but also talking to a lot of groups, human rights, social justice groups that are interested in this issue. And of course, a member of Katiba Institute, which is doing a lot of work in terms of public interest litigation.
Yeah.
So that would be, you know, a brief sketch of, you know, of it.
Having known you now for close to 50 years, I have seen the journey, and I know you've been very, very consistent with this work.
Mm.
And I want to take you back a little, because you have mentioned some really key areas.
Mm.
And one of the things you have mentioned is that the constitution making does not end with the document itself.
Yeah.
And I think that takes us now to the whole question of the distinction between the constitution and constitutionalism itself.
Yes.
If you could just create that distinction.
The constitution is, people tend to look at it as the legal document.
Yes.
Yeah, the document that is legal centric. And that is now the charter. Okay. Which is
basically the
pact itself. Yeah, yeah. And it's very abstract, because there are certain things, you know, it's giving you a vision that you will have a democratic state, you will have this and the other, the elections will be free and fair, and so forth. I think constitutionalism is the late Okoth Ogendo, because he wrote a brilliant piece called Constitution Without Constitutionalism.
Yes.
Okay.
An amazing piece.
Yeah. And he was looking at exactly what you are saying. The implementation is breathing life into what is a legal-centric document, and which is abstract. So the values that are in the Constitution, the implementation, the struggles between the implementation and where there is a resistance to implementation, which is our history now, and we see it very clearly. That particular, you know, struggle, you can say is a struggle towards constitutionalism. So that these values we have decreed in the Constitution become a reality. It's like if you take, for example, the issue of the vision in the Constitution of a democratic, secular state and society.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's still being fought in court, yeah, and it's still being fought outside court, so that we can accept that vision. It hasn't been accepted because there are still, what we see, there are still divisions between the religions, and within the religions, there are sects that are, you know, also fighting. And so the coexistence is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And Article 8 said that there is no state religion. The whole constitution vision is that of secularism.
Secular state.
So that the devil worshippers, the traditional ones, atheists, humanists, the secretism is called, all those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And actually, when you look at the constitution, that probably is the best vision. If we implemented that, we can hand over to the world, which I haven't seen any other constitution that deals with that issue of diversity.
Yeah.
And you see it in the preamble, saying we have a religious diversity, cultural and ethnic, but we say that's our strength.
Mm.
So it's the same vision. And, you know, constitutionalism, of course, is that terrain of a struggle to achieve a particular goal. And as we have found out, of course, it's the fundamental factor in moving towards constitutionalism is the ruling class that is implementing the constitution.
So constitutionalism is behavioral.
Yeah,
it's a giving life,
yes,
to the spirit,
yes,
of the constitution itself.
Yeah,
and it's also a commitment.
Yeah.
Of duty bearers,
yes,
institutions, and so on, to, yes, do whatever they...
And radical reforms in areas that guarantee, like if it's, say, Article 43 of the Constitution on socio-economic and cultural rights, you need resources, you need to deal with the issue of land, you need to deal with universal health care, education, and so forth.
So political power becomes important,
yeah,
then. Like,
yes,
who is sitting,
yeah,
in the executive,
yes,
to determine the ways in which the breathing of life,
that's,
becomes,
right,
possible.
That's right. And that's why in the case of Kenya, we say, you know, we have a great constitution, a beautiful baby, but we have given it to, yeah, child traffickers.
Yeah. So, which now takes me, and we will get into this conversation, which then shows the ways in which constitutions are actually also political documents, as it were.
Yeah, you're right. Although the lawyers don't see this, you know, quickly,
mm-hmm,
a constitution is a legal, political, and ideological document.
Yeah.
That's why it becomes a site of struggle.
Yes.
You know, because when you go to how the constitution is interpreted, the courts now have realized that you cannot leave what lawyers used to call the non-legal phenomena, including politics, theology, science, sociology, economics. When you look at the Kenya Constitution, it actually encompasses all those. You know, when we did the case on digital migration, I didn't know what a spectrum was. We had to get scientists and people to come and tell you.
The experts.
Yes. Yes, so the constitution.
So the judges get educated by the professionals.
By professionals. Who will tell you this is what it means, and, you know, and so forth. And that's why these constitutions, when they are called transformative, is to basically say they move from what the lawyers call legal positivism, where you just say the law is a law is a law. You don't want to be told, well, what about the politics of it? What about theological arguments? Now you have God in the Constitution. What about the economics? You know, you were talking about land and how there should be the vision of land is that we ultimately have access to land for all Kenyans when you look at the Constitution. But it sees, you know, the what I might call the minefields. Which is private property, Article 40. And how do they mitigate this? They say very clearly, okay, foreigners will not have freehold. And those who are freehold, we can always compulsorily acquire it and pay compensation. And then there's that beautiful Article 68. Going forward, we are going to have minimum and maximum acreage of land. And, of course, the National Land Commission, which is going to hold the lands that are, were grabbed, once they come back, they don't come back to the state. Article 61, I think, which says very clearly that land in Kenya belongs to Kenyans as a nation, mm-hmm. and as individuals, mm-hmm. and then communities. Mm-hmm. So there are those, you know, categorization. And you can see the vision.
That is very interesting. I mean, yeah. I recall, you know, the idea of maximum land ownership, yes. was, there was an attempt to introduce legislation, mm-hmm. in the 1970s,
yeah.
by Koigi wa Mwere.
Yes.
In which he had actually proposed, and I think I recall, mm-hmm. that bill, that, mm-hmm. that the maximum acreage by an individual ought to be about 500 acres. I remember something vague like that.
Yeah.
So I find it quite interesting that, mm. this idea.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually 68. There was some MP who was talking about it without obviously reading the constitution.
Yeah.
Saying he's going to table a bill about maximum acreage. It's there in the, yeah. and actually it's parliament that is supposed to debate it.
Yeah.
Okay, and once they would debate it, of course, with robust public participation.
That
it's a big thing, and it's a great example of a site of struggle, yeah. because the landowners, even if we tell them we'll pay you just and, you know, adequate compensation.
They don't want to let go.
They don't,
yeah,
want
in
to
fact, my view has always been that you cannot discuss, mm. the Kenyan political trajectory, mm. without reference to the struggles over land.
You can't, because it's tied up with the resources.
Absolutely.
And, you know, even in terms of food.
Basic, mm? Survival.
Basic survival. You know, those who don't even have an acre of land have a, you know, an issue. But I think the Constitution understood that and took the incremental strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a radical political leadership, okay, you can actually
accelerate the process. Yeah.
Yes, because why are people having half a million hectares, mm. and they don't use all of it?
Yeah.
Okay, and we know which families have it. Why are multinationals, you know, who actually got that land for free? So those issues are coming up, you know, like the case in the European Court of Human Rights, where the Talai and the Kipsigis are suing for reparations.
The Talai, of course, having been moved from Uasin Gishu to Kericho,
yeah.
and all that, and their land taken, actually even to Kisumu,
yeah.
they were being moved to create space for...
You are absolutely right. The Mau Mau did not call the army land and freedom for nothing.
Yeah. They knew what they were talking about. Absolutely.
They knew what they were talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. It seems then, mm-hmm. that constitutions, mm. and the idea, mm. of organizing society, mm. Almost innate, almost like, mm-hmm. natural.
Yeah.
So Kenya becomes a colony in 1920.
Mm.
And of course, then we are subjected to the British way of interpreting, you know, the state and
yes,
so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kenya then becomes, mm. kind, you know, as a Kenya colony.
Mm.
Kenyan communities had constitutions,
yes.
before the British, yeah. occupation of our country, isn't it?
Yeah, they had just like the British don't have a written constitution,
yeah.
but they have what you might call, you know, an unwritten constitution.
Yeah.
So if I give you my example of my community in the 50s under colonialism, there was that parallel development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the elders were there, discussions about grazing, about watering holes, and how disputes were to be, you know, resolved,
yeah.
and so forth. How you dealt with the bringing up of children, how you shared community, you know, resources. Because in the 50s, land in Kitui hadn't been titled. It wasn't a commodity. It was community land. And so there were obviously disputes about cattle trespass and whatnot. But the community said that. I mean, I always say that there was never a vacuum. And the British, of course, got into us through the native courts.
Mm.
And there, some people will go there on issues of dowry where they couldn't agree and so forth. But growing up in Kitui, a lot of disputes were settled through the Kithito oath. You know, the people didn't go to any court. They would just say, okay, if you guys, you can't agree, then let's settle this by Kithito
oath. By oathing.
Yes, and that was, you know, it's if they were writing a constitution.
Absolutely.
In terms of, you know, the courts, instead of the jurisprudence, the Supreme Court will be the Kithito oath.
Absolutely.
End of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what is interesting for me then is the coexistence, plural coexistence, of the so-called formal.
Formal.
In quotes, eh?
Yeah,
and the so-called informal in quotes.
Yeah,
because they are also institutionalized. Even the so-called informal are actually institutionalized. They have a system.
Actually, that's a brilliant point. I don't know why the so-called informal is not called formal, because it's the one that is accessible to 95% of the people. The other one is 5.
Absolutely, and we will revisit that question on how the so-called informal institutions make their way into the Kenyan constitution.
Yes.
Because I think that was absolutely innovative.
Yeah.
I think it was very considerate of our communities.
Yes.
And again, puts the supremacy of the people at the center of our constitution.
That's right.
Yeah. This concludes our first episode in our 3-part series of this podcast about constitution making in Kenya with Chief Justice Professor Willy Mutunga, President of the Supreme Court of Kenya. Thank you for listening to the Africa Speaking Podcast. Join us in our next episode, brought to you by Triazer Communications. My name is Kimani Njogu. For any comments and views, you can reach us through our website, www.africaspeaking.org. You can also reach us on Facebook, Triazer Communications, or on our Twitter handle, at TriazerComs. You can also write to us on email info@africaspeaking.org.